Welcome to the Defence Forces podcast, brought to you by the Defence Forces Public Relations Branch.
Hello and welcome to the Irish Defence Forces podcast. My name is Captain Cian Clancy, and today we're going to be speaking to Captain Eugene Mohan about the use of helicopters in the Defence Forces, from military operations with the Army and Naval Service to the Emergency Air and Medical Service. So thanks for coming on, Eugene. Much appreciated.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Cian.
So, as I always kind of do, what I'm going to do just to refresh my own memory as much as for any other reason is just to go through what we're going to talk about. So we're going to have a quick breakdown. We're going to hear about your own background and like what interested you in joining the Air Corps in the first place. And then we're going to talk a bit about helicopters in the Defence Forces, kind of the early origins and what helicopter platforms we operate today. And then the roles of the heli in the Defence Forces. We could talk a bit about working with the Army and the Naval Service, a bit about our aid to the civil authority operations and things like aerial firefighting and assisting civil authorities. And then we're going to talk a bit about the Emergency Air Medical Service. But first of all, how long have you been in the Air Corps?
I joined the Air Corps in 2011 and started my cadetship then. I got commissioned then 2014, Valentine's Day. So it was a good day. And since that then, I've been posted into the number 3 operations wing in the Air Corps, which is the unit that carries out all helicopter operations.
Okay, right. And did you always want to be a pilot, or what was it? I know, having spoken to Niall Dungan a few weeks ago about the Air Corps cadetship, you kind of get a choice towards in the training within reason of what you'd like to fly. Was it always helicopters? Or?
Yeah, helicopters were, I suppose, the aircraft itself is very interesting in that it's, you know, one of those things that you can land it anywhere and take off from anywhere. And the engineering behind it and how it actually stays in the air was always very interesting. So yeah, being a pilot was always interesting to me, but also the type of operations that helicopters are involved in was something that I found very appealing, because there's such a variety of operations that a helicopter can do.
Okay.
And they're very appealing for, I suppose, myself.
The sheer sort of, there's a certain amount of amazement to see something like helicopter flying, because it's so, you know, it's almost incongruous, you know, this thing is whirling around and flying.
Yeah, that's it. Like, and with a helicopter compared to, I suppose, an airplane, there's so many moving parts in a helicopter, between the engines up into the rotor head system and to the rotor blades that are spinning around quite fast. It's an interesting piece of engineering.
There is a certain amount, as we discussed before, that like there is a fairly long period of training after your cadetship to qualify you to fly a helicopter, a conversion course over from, say, the more conventional fixed wing flying you would have done before.
Yeah, so after we complete a cadetship, cadetships can vary in time, but every pilot in the Air Corps will train on the Pilatus PC-9. So I know Captain Niall Dungan mentioned the Air Corps cadetship previously. So that's every pilot would fly that aircraft first. And once you get commissioned and get your wings and you're qualified pilot, you will then have the choice. And sometimes you may not have the choice, depending on where the vacancies are in the Air Corps, whether you either stay fixed wing or you can move into helicopters. I was lucky enough that I got to pick helis, and I was lucky enough that the vacancies were there, and that's where I went in. So I started my HCC after I finished the cadetship, and the HCC stands for your helicopter conversion course. That's flying the 135 helicopter. So,
which is the smaller one for anybody?
Yeah, it's a smaller helicopter. It's a single pilot operation, so one pilot can fly the EC-135, or it has skids, it doesn't have wheels, and it has it's just a smaller footprint of an aircraft.
Yeah.
And that's where we'd start our training on helis. You start off with just learning how to do the basics, so that simple as trying to hold a hover. That can be one of the most challenging things when you move from an airplane onto a helicopter, is actually just figuring out how to hover a helicopter. Once you master that, then it's on to different disciplines such as straight and level, climbing, descending, and starting at the basics, moving forward then into some of the other operational roles and operational disciplines that we do. We also train for them in the helicopter conversion course.
And like, just approximately, how long is the helicopter conversion course, just roughly? I know that it's dependent a bit on the conditions for flying and things, but...
Yeah, so it depends. It depends on aircraft availability and weather and a few other variables that can change and that we have no control over. On average, you're talking in the region of maybe 6 months to 8 months for a helicopter conversion course. Everything from the basics of actually flying the aircraft to the operational roles. And some of those operational roles may be attaching loads to the bottom of the aircraft and lifting different loads. It can be simulated winching or actual winching, air gunnery, troop transport, firefighting, and that's about our different roles.
A lot of other different roles. A lot of them we're going to go into a little bit later as we move on in the podcast. But helicopters in the Defence Forces and in the Irish Air Corps, like, you mentioned that it's been going on for quite some time.
The Air Corps were the first in the state to operate helicopters, and that was back in the 60s when they operated the Alouettes. They were involved in many different roles, supporting the Army, but also in search and rescue. We've moved forward in terms of our aerial platforms and helicopters, and we're now operating the AW139 aircraft, which is Gusta Weston 139. It's a medium lift helicopter, weighs about 6.5 tons, and it takes 2 pilots to fly it. We also have the EC-135s, which are smaller helicopters that we spoke about. That's a single pilot operation, but generally for training we would have 2 pilots in the front, the instructor and the student, and then for certain operations we may have a second pilot on the EC-135. But they're the two aircraft that we're operating at the minute. Yeah. And they're quite modern in terms of their cockpit and their avionics. They've what's called a glass cockpit. It's all different screens. And we can bring up different displays, and we've lots of different information. So they're quite advanced aircraft and quite fast actually as well. So,
what kind of speed are we looking at for, say, for example, the larger one, the AW139, or which one is quicker?
The 139 is a lot quicker. 135 is a bit slower, but in terms of top end speed on the 139, you're looking at 167 knots, which is it at its fastest speed.
Yeah.
So in rough figures, in range, 200 miles an hour. So it's quite fast. And the other thing that you have to bear in mind is that generally we go in a straight line. There's no bends or roads that we have to follow. But if we're going in a straight line and the weather conditions are good, we can get there pretty quickly.
Yeah.
They're a fast aircraft and they're very capable.
And what kind of a range for a full tank of fuel are we talking for, say, this Fade 139, which we will talk about later on with regard to, say, EAS, if you have to go a long distance? How far can it go before it needs to refuel?
139 can take about 3 hours worth of fuel, give or take. Again, it depends on the conditions on the day. If you've if you're flying at certain speeds, you might burn through fuel quicker. But yeah, it's about 3 hours worth of fuel.
Okay.
So about 1.3 tons of fuel in total. Wow. We can carry in the aircraft.
Okay, and that's obviously in addition to, and then you have equipment and you have people in the aircraft, and then any loads that you need to lift.
Yeah, exactly. So we'd have 2 pilots up the front and a crewman in the back of the aircraft, and that would kind of be the basic configuration for a 139 helicopter. So the 2 pilots, people always ask the question, why do we need 2 pilots in the front of the helicopter? And that's because the 139 has a lot of different systems, and some of those systems can be quite complicated in terms of the avionics and, you know, the different radios that we have on board, because we have numerous radios for talking to different people, as well as air traffic control. So it can get quite busy in the cockpit. And then if you throw in bad weather into the mix, you know, you need someone to help out with the navigation as well. So 2 pilots is there to manage the workload and divide up the different tasks between one person flying, one person operating the systems, and then they can swap over and take turns flying, etc. So the crewman in the back, then he's the person that helps to guide us into some of those tight landing spots. Depending on the type of operation we're doing, we can land the aircraft in quite small spaces, and it's the crewman that opens the door, the side of the helicopter leans out, and he watches our tail also, but he helps to direct us into those landing sites.
Okay, we'll be talking later on, say, about the kind of operation, the teamwork operation inside a heli for any number of roles that we talk about. But obviously you can see that importance of teamwork there already. It's not only working with the aircraft, you're also working with the other 2 people that are in the aircraft with you.
The big thing with heli operations is communication and teamwork, and they're very, very important because everybody has a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we're operating as part of a team, we're not going to be able to fulfill the mission. So I lead a course called CRM, Crew Resource Management, every year in the Air Corps. And in that, then, it tells us all about how to communicate effectively, but also how to work together. Leadership, teamwork, all those different things come into it. So it's really, really important. And some of the stuff that we're going to chat about later on in terms of firefighting and EAS, you can see why teamwork is very important.
We talked about the AW139 and the kind of capabilities it has, but what kind of roles in the modern defence forces do we have for helicopters?
So supporting the Army is an important role for the Air Corps, and in particular helis. And there's a number of different capabilities and things that we can do. Troop transport is a big one. We can insert and extract troops as required or as requested. So they can be into different areas. It could be up into the mountains that we can deliver troops, or we can take them from different barracks, etc. So,
and that's with both landing the aircraft. You can also do there's a fast roping element as well.
Yeah, so it depends on the situation, but sometimes we would have troops that can fast rope from the aircraft, so sliding down a rope into different locations. And also the likes of abseiling and para-ops as well. They're all insertion methods that we would help with in the helis. So troop transports, in terms of the numbers that we can put into the back of an AW139, you can take about 12 troops. Then it depends on the kit that they're carrying. Sometimes we could take a little bit less if they're carrying a lot of extra weight in terms of their backpacks. The 135 can do the same sort of roles and same sort of capabilities, but generally it's just smaller kind of sizes, so less people, less backpacks, etc.
I've been into the back of both, and like the 135 is a much sort of a smaller sort of affair, like, isn't it? It's what kind of capacity did you say the 135 might have in the back? Is it like six something or is it?
Yeah, it generally about five seats, and then we could have the crewman to floor strap. So about four or five is kind of what we would tend to take in troop. Troop transport configuration and the 135. Some of the other stuff then the 139 can do and the 135, it can also provide air gunnery. So we can put on a general purpose machine gun onto the side of the 139s, which is quite interesting, and it's always dynamic and good flying to be involved in. We also have a sniper platform that we can operate from the aircraft.
And we spoke earlier about kind of cargo lift, like, as in there must be an element to that with regard to supporting the Army or the Naval Service as well.
The aircraft can carry lots of different loads. Sometimes we put those loads inside the aircraft. So in a way, you can bolt bits on and take bits off the aircraft and change the configuration in the cockpit. And we can carry loads internally as well as externally. And the external loads, we can carry a lot heavier weight. So some of the stuff that we do at the Army, we'd be carrying the 105 gun for the artillery, but also the carrying the likes of the engineers have a particular specialised type of bridge platform that we can carry in different sections, as well as sometimes we carry backpacks and different loads that are set up in cargo bags and cargo nets. So yeah, there's a big variety of loads that we can carry and how we can package them and how we can lift them. It's always good fun as well doing that type of flying.
And what kind of a tonnage lift are we sort of talking about that a 139 would be able to pull?
It depends. So if we're carrying very heavy loads such as the 105, which is about 1.5 ton, I think, we may have to take less fuel. So I know we mentioned earlier that the 139 can take about 1.3 ton of fuel.
Yeah.
But we take less if we're carrying heavy weights on the outside of the aircraft.
So it obviously will affect the range.
Exactly, yeah.
As a commander employing a 139 to lift something somewhere, you have to be aware of all these payloads and things.
Yeah, so we kind of weigh it up. And even with the firefighting, you know, the Bambi buckets that we would chat about later, they're about 1.3 ton, about 1,300 litres of water. So
also, there's a kind of surveillance and recce role that can be done as well.
From time to time, we would have a request to carry out reconnaissance or recces or different surveillance, and that can be for surveillance, and that can be for different courses and training. And that's another military role that we would carry out for the Army. It's good because it can have different types of flying, different profiles, so whether we're high or low or doing kind of low level flying or tactical type flying.
I mean, there are kind of scenarios that we'd be talking about here. I was mentioning before use of a fire support team commander for the artillery on board a 139, when it's like if you were firing, like we spoke about the shoot that they did out in West Cork off the coast.
Yeah, and the Naval Service actually, and that's something that we can do, we can watch the fall of shot. So the Naval Service have requested us for numerous different things as well. But one of those was to the new ships that they got and the new guns to help with calibrating or zeroing those weapon systems. So one of the roles that we had to do was maintain a hover downrange outside the arcs of fire, basically video record or record the fall of shots, so where the actual rounds were landing in relation to the target. And that was interesting flying because we're maybe 16, 17 kilometres away from the ship. It's firing at a target, tiny little target out in the sea, and we're watching that target or the round impacting the water close to that target. So that's another interesting role that we have carried out before. Some of the stuff then that we would help with the Naval Service or that we'd complete with the Naval Service, but like I said, the helicasting. So I know previous podcast, one of the military divers was on and he mentioned helicasting, and that's another insertion method of troops. So what we do is get low to the water, slow down the aircraft, and the divers in the back would jump into the water from a slow forward hover.
Yeah, and I've seen some really good images of that. And they go in, and then their equipment is also dropped in as well.
Yeah, sometimes they'll have the equipment attached and sometimes they'll go in after them. But yeah, I think it's meant to be quite a thrill when they're jumping out of the aircraft into the water. And makes for good flying as well, in terms of getting down low and getting all the spray from the water up around the aircraft that can circulate in and out. So it's quite good.
So there's a lot, like from there you can see, like there's an awful lot of kind of logistics roles and different things that an aircraft will offer commanders on the ground for both the naval service and the army and other services. And you also work to a certain extent from aid to civil power with an Garda Síochána as well.
Yeah, that's something that we would provide from time to time. Different roles or different requests would come in, and depending on what the situation is or what the type of request is, we would provide that capability to the aid to the civil power and Garda Síochána. So again, some of the capabilities that we've spoke about, insertion, extraction, or the likes of reconnaissance.
Yeah, or possibly cargo. If these options are open to the guards, well, if they request them.
Yes.
And yeah. So that's aid to the civil power, and obviously we move on like aid to the civil authority as well. So in the event of say emergency situations or kind of natural disasters or things, the aircraft can provide a capability to like civil authorities and things like county council and stuff as well.
Yeah, and that's one of the roles that we would carry out. Some of the stuff that we've done in the past for local authorities would be likes of cargo slinging different loads, such as bales of straw, bales of hay and fodder into marooned animals, say, after flooding.
Yeah.
So we've carried that out before, down around the Athlone area.
So it's when roads aren't available because of flooding or because of a natural disaster, then the sky is fairly clear.
Yeah, exactly. What we found is that sometimes with the flooding, there may be animals on the land and the animals are marooned and the farmers can't get them in off the land. And we've been requested previously to help drop in fodder and feed onto these animals. So that's quite interesting. And some of the stuff we've done previously with the OPW could be the likes of skelligs, where we've dropped out some building materials and repair work, say, after storms for different locations that are, I suppose, remote or secluded. A helicopter's a great platform to drop in these materials or anything that's required. It could be even personnel from the local authority or from the OPW that we'd help out and lift in.
There's assisting the civil authority during, say, flooding, but also one of the more visible parts of the aid to the civil authority operations is aerial firefighting.
Aerial firefighting has been a big part, I suppose, recently with all this dry weather that we're having. The ground is quite dry and there has been a number of fires around the country. And every year, actually, we've been quite busy in recent years in terms of aerial firefighting.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do, or how does it work? Aerial firefighting, there's a couple of different ways we can do it, but I suppose one of the more practical ways one of the more efficient ways would be to have two aircraft deploy for any type of fire. So we'd have the 135 aircraft or helicopter with a deploy is along with a 139, AW-139 helicopter. The 135 then, we would tend to land into the scene or land into the fire and they get a fire officer on board or one of the...
Obviously not into the fire itself, but in nearby.
Yeah. Down the road. somewhere safe. We'd land in and we get the fire officer on board or one of the team members from the ground.
Yeah.
Get them into the aircraft, into the 135. And I suppose then they act like the command and control. And what they can do then is coordinate the whole thing and help to, direct the 139 aircraft into a position. Spoke about the 139 earlier and how it's two pilots and a crewman in the back and they would be in comms then with the 135 who would help to direct them onto the fire. One of the big things that we look for as well is a water source that is close by to the fire. The whole idea of aerial firefighting is that if we have a water source that's close in terms of maybe 1 or 2 minutes flight time, it means that we can drop a lot of water very quickly on the fire. It's not really ideal if we have to travel long distances between each drop. If we can get that down to a couple of minutes, that's what really makes a big impact on a fire. So we can drop water rapidly and we can drop a lot of it quickly over a short period of time. Bambi bucket is what we use. It's a big red bucket that's attached to the belly of the aircraft. That can hold up to 1,300 litres of water. It's kind of made of a rubber. Pilots in the front, they would have a control or a button in the front that they can press on their cyclic. That will allow them to drop all the water out of the bucket.
Yeah.
So the crewman in the back, so we spoke about him earlier, he's the guy that's happened to direct us in over the water source. So that can be the sea, it could be a river, it could be a lake, or it could be a man-made hole in the ground that the fire service have dug for us and filled with water.
But you mentioned when we were chatting about this, which I've never heard before, and I kind of found fascinating that. But it makes sense. I mean, if the fire brigade have access to large amounts of water and it needs to happen, but I would have never thought of that before.
Yes, so some locations that we would find the fires is that there'd be no water source close by.
Probably one of the reasons why the ground is so dry.
Yeah, exactly. And what we found works well is the fire service would dig a hole, fill it with one of the tankers, and then we're able to replenish and use that as a water source to fight the fire. And it's worked quite well. We actually used it recently in Enfield. So we land in, the crewman will direct us in over this the water source, we'll fill the Bambi bucket, and then the crewman will take us in over the fire. Aerial firefighting is dangerous flying. We're in low, we're in risk of hitting obstacles or wires or different things that we mightn't see straight away. And there's also the Bambi bucket hanging from the aircraft. Other things to consider then is the actual fire itself in terms of the smoke. And if you think about the engines on board the aircraft, well, they need oxygen to burn and to burn the fuel. So if we fly through thick, dense smoke, well, there's potential there that you could flame out your engines on the helicopter. So helicopter firefighting operations are particularly dangerous, and the crews need high skill levels in order to complete this task. But again, it's very rewarding flying. And you can really have an impact into the operation and to the mission, into the firefighting.
Yeah, so. And we've seen like on stuff we would put on social media recently, like the shots and the short videos from actually the crewman inside the 139 as the water's dropped. And you can really see the impact of that amount of water on a fire. And also, you wouldn't think that a fire is so big, but like you can really see the sheer extent of it from the air. And I think we would have seen images from recent operations, say in Enfield and stuff, that look really, really big.
Yeah, Enfield was a bad fire in terms of the height of the flames. And it's only when you get down low into the fire that you can actually see the extent. And some of those flames could be 50 to 100 feet high. So they're quite intense, especially when they get into the likes of forestry. The fires can take off. And then added with a little bit of wind and the dry weather conditions that we're having, some of those fires can get quite big. Over the last couple of months alone, we've been in Enfield, we've been in Kildare, we've been in Connemara and Donegal, and even up in County Louth, where we've been fighting fires. The one in Louth in particular, I think the aircraft were there for about 3 days fighting fires. And again, it's not about just putting out fires, we're also protecting people's properties that are in the vicinity of these fires. So it is quite important, and people, in the unit do get a real sense of satisfaction out of this type of flying.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we talked about earlier about kind of teamwork as well, and that like in this instance, like you've got the teamwork in the aircraft, but you're also working with the fire controller in a different aircraft who's directing it to where you need to actually, where the water needs to go.
That teamwork, none of this will happen. It's really, really important. And the communication, good communication, it's really, really important with this. You can see sometimes we wouldn't have the availability of a 135 helicopter to help guide us in. Not a showstopper, we can still complete firefighting, but it does help. It helps to make it a bit more efficient, and we can coordinate and have that
more
kind
accurate,
of...
More accurate, yeah.
Yeah.
As I said, it's one of the more visible parts of the heli operation, especially during the summer, is the aerial firefighting. But another very visible part of the operations with helicopters from the perspective of the Defence Forces is the Emergency Air Medical Service. As we discussed before, we actually started recording the podcast, the Air Corps is involved in an awful lot of kind of air ambulance and area-based kind of ambulance operations. But what we're talking about now with regard to the Heli Emergency Air Medical Service.
So EES stands for Emergency Air Medical Service, and that's really our 999 type medical emergencies. And that aircraft is based in Lone. But we also operate other air ambulance duties and rosters in the Air Corps, and that can be for fixed-wing aircraft, and also some of the other helicopters that are in Baldonnell, and they're more kind of an inter-hospital type air ambulance duty.
Yeah.
So that may be for the likes of patient transfers from different hospitals or organ harvesting as requested by the ambulance service.
Yeah.
EAS is more like rapid response, 999 calls, so the likes of heart attacks, car crashes, all these types of accidents. Where we need to respond quickly.
So go through for us like the process of, so you're on duty as a EAS helicopter pilot, or indeed as a crewman or as a HC paramedic or something like that. So what happens when you get a call?
So when we get a call in EAS, it's very much a team event. We know exactly what each person is doing, and we all have really specific roles. So again, it's an AW139 helicopter, so two pilots up the front. We have a crewman in the back who's an Air Corps crewman, medically trained, so he's either an EMT or a paramedic.
Yeah.
And then we also have a HSE, advanced paramedic, from the National Ambulance Service in the back of the aircraft. We have two technicians then that are also based with us for EAS, and they complete daily inspections of the aircraft as well as any technical or maintenance issues that we have on the detachment in Athlone. Athlone is where EAS is based. And it was picked because it's the geographical centre of the country. And if you were to draw rings around that lawn, we show a response time the different areas, and we can get there quite quickly.
Yeah.
So Athlone is a really good location for that. When a call comes in, so how does it happen? The advanced paramedic will get a phone call from the National Ambulance Control Centre, which is based in Dublin, and they'll give details such as the location and the type of incident. Once we get that call, we'll have a quick look at the weather to make sure that it's good or not good. And if we accept the call, the pilot will accept it. And then the co-pilot will remain in the ops room in Athlone with the advanced paramedic and the crewman. The pilot, or the P1, will walk to the aircraft. He'll start up the aircraft while the advanced paramedic is still on the phone with the P2, or the co-pilot. And they are then planning the route, planning the navigation, and planning the landing site. So we'll get a latitude and longitude, or we'll get an air code of where the call is located. The crewman then will go to the map on the wall, and he'll work out rough headings and rough timings, while we, the co-pilot and the advanced paramedic, work out a slightly more accurate landing site using software that we have available to us for that. So once that's completed, pilot or the P1 should have the aircraft started up, and the techs would also help in that. We should be all in the aircraft and in the air within that kind of 7 or 8 minutes time, routing to the scene. So it's quite quick and it's quite rapid. It means that we must kind of stay in the vicinity of the building in order to respond quickly, that we can't leave, we can't go outside or leave the ops room. Generally we'd stay there and we'd have our meals there, etc. So yeah, we're always ready to respond, always quickly, to aim to get into the air within that kind of 6-7 minutes.
Okay, well, and you've already mentioned like who's in the back of the heli and who we have with you. So you have quite a good deal of medical capability in it as well, between your paramedic and your crewman and your advanced paramedic.
Yeah, exactly. The level of care that patient will get in the back is quite high. In terms of medical status, they call it ALS, Advanced Life Support. And that's where the advanced paramedic, he can administer lots of different medications and provide that support along with the air corps crewman. That alone is quite a high level of care. So even if we're going to some of the remote parts in the country, whether it's Clifton or Letterflack or Cleggan, all these different areas that are quite remote, sometimes we can get there quite ahead of the ambulance that's on the road.
Yeah.
So we're able to provide that ALS, advanced life support, to the patient quickly. But we're also able then to pick that patient and take them to a definitive care centre. So a definitive care centre as in one of the hospitals that's appropriate for the type of patient that
it's
we have.
Best suited, which was what we said, you were saying when we discussed, which I think is interesting, is because, as we discussed earlier, an aircraft can go in a straight line from A to B at a very high speed. It's not about going to the place that's nearest to you.
Yeah, sometimes we would go to, say, a hospital that specialises in a type of injury or a type of, say, Beaumont in Dublin specialises with head injuries, and you know, we may bypass a hospital to go directly to that definitive care. That's under the direction of the advanced paramedic in the back of the aircraft. He can tell us or ask us to go to certain hospitals to get that definitive level of care. So overall, the level of care that the patient gets is quite high, and the service has been a massive success in terms of number of lives saved. We've lifted thousands of patients from every county in the country, and the service has been up and running the last over 8 years now, and it's been very, very successful. Sometimes people see the big green aircraft and ask us what we're doing. It's when we get chatting to people, when we meet them at scenes, that we explain to them this is the Emergency Aeromedical Service, we're based in Athlone, and that we're here in conjunction with the HSE and the Defence Forces.
Yeah, and I imagine you must get a great deal of satisfaction out of doing that job, as in bringing people to a hospital to get kind of care that may have resulted in loss of life or serious permanent injury if we did not have the service, or that you had not been available.
For sure, yeah. Some of the cases, like the different types of calls are quite interesting. We get a lot of trauma calls, so a lot of fireman accidents, a lot of, say, injuries on building sites or industrial sites. But a lot of trauma and a lot of car crashes and any serious call, really, we tend to be there. As well as that, we have patients that have had heart attacks and strokes. And again, it's about getting them to that definitive level of care. We can do that quickly. Doing that quickly, as well as bringing the advanced life support in terms of the advanced paramedic to the patient quickly and getting the patient quickly to the definitive care, the outcomes can be quite good in terms for the patient. So some of the feedback that we get from patients from time to time is that it really has made a difference to them and that it saved their lives. And that's quite satisfying for the crews and all the people that are involved in EES and in the Air Corps, because it's not just about the pilots that are actually flying the helicopter. It's about the people that are in the flight training school in Baldonnell that are training the new pilots. It's about the instructors in the apprentice school that are training the new technicians. It's about everybody. It's all the support staff and everybody that actually helps to make these operations work, because without all of those people in the background providing all the different services and all the different support, that aircraft would not operate. So we need all that support.
And this is the ultimate expression of that team ethos that we've talked about a lot during the podcast.
Exactly, yeah. And that's right across the Defence Forces for all the different types of ops that we do. Without that, a lot of times these things wouldn't happen. So it is really, really, really important.
So at the end of that, thanks very much for coming on to the show, Eugene. It's very much appreciated.
No problem at all.
There's a huge amount of info there, I think, for anybody that has their own academic interest in helicopters and the Defence Forces, or indeed for anybody looking to join. So you might get a couple of potential pilots out of it.
Yeah, it'd be great. We're always looking for people, and anyone that's interested in it, it'd be great to have them.
So as always, keep an eye on Defence Forces social media and military.ie for further updates on the Irish Defence Forces. Serving members are encouraged to check out the members area of military.ie for updates. Today's episode was produced by Gunnar Pádraic Sullivan and Sergeant Paul Keeley of the Defence Forces Audiovisual School. And as always, the Irish Defence Forces podcast will be back soon with another episode. Until then, stay safe.